Welcome to the Todd and Noah Show, taking the mystery out of electric motors. Once again, we have Noah Bethel, the Vice President of Product Development for PDMA Corporation.
And hello from sunny Tampa, Florida, broadcast from Fort Myers.
I didn't cut him off that time.
That's all right.
And I'm Todd Gunderson, the Vice President of City. Now, you see?
It's a little weird. It's a little different.
I'm the Vice President of Sales and Marketing, and we're coming to you guys again. You guys have listened to quite a few of our podcasts, hopefully, and I'm actually coming off a 72-hour fast, so I'm feeling pretty frisky right now.
Completely amazing to me.
Cognitively sharp.
I would be a little...
Be ready.
I'd be in the ground.
Well, you're fasting, too. You're
not like 72 hours.
Well, you do it every day.
Every day.
I only do it once a month. 72 hours once a month for health benefits.
I don't think I could do it. I'll be honest with you.
You can do anything that you set your mind to.
That's what I've heard.
You can do it. It's easy. Like I said, once you hit the 24-hour mark, it's pretty simple because then you're burning ketones and body fat is coming off. And just good things are happening to you.
sounds rough.
That's amazing.
I'll have to do some study on
that. Yeah, you'll have to study up on that. I do share with you all my notes. So
yes, yeah, it's intriguing.
It is intriguing. Well, Noah, we have as we go through our podcasts, couple things that we really haven't talked about yet, and it's a feature in what we analyze, and we call it our time domain.
Yes.
Demodulation.
Demodulation is a great word. In fact, current demodulation is probably a proper term to use because we are demodulating our current signal. And by doing that, you know, it's like a radio, right? If you think about it, you know, an AM amplitude modulation, we're demodulating, right? So we're going to take a current signal, which has a whole bunch of stuff in it, including line frequency, and we're going to extract the modulating components of that, clean out the line frequency so we can see into the grass, you know, stuff that we normally would not see.
Like we've always talked about a seventh fault zone, machine train analysis. Does it fit into that seventh fault zone? We just never put it there because six are what we're known for.
Well, I got vetoed for it's not the motor. You know, I thought that would be a great fault zone. It's not the motor, right? And, you know, it comes back to the 15-foot rule of troubleshooting. If there's a problem with a system, and there's an electrical cable within 15 feet, then it must be an electrical problem, right? Until we prove otherwise. But I agree with you. We could easily say, you know, there's power quality, power circuit, insulation, stator, rotor, air gap. That's the main six.
Yeah.
Seven could be machine train.
Seven we keep open for anything that is.
That's right. All else.
To us. All other things fall into that.
That's right.
Fault zone.
I like it.
So demodulation uses. Number one. Pole pass. How is it used? How do we find pole pass?
Right. So in previous, you know, discussions and case studies and stuff, we've focused on pole pass, which again, if you think about the rotating magnetic field of the stator winding, and like in an induction motor, of course, you've got the rotor going slower than the stator magnetic field, and that difference in speed creates a modulation at pole pass. So as the poles in the rotor pass the poles in the stator, that's a modulation. And we can track that, and it's very indicative of rotor anomalies as a primary. Vibration industry uses pole pass around running speed and stuff, as well as to indicate, you know, various anomalies. So it's out there. It's definitely a very strong electrical signal, and we use it a lot for a lot of things, including machine train. What's nice about a use in demodulation, where in the normal rotor evaluation or current signature, pole pass is a sideband around line frequency. So in North America, if you're looking at 60 hertz as a line frequency, you might have a peak at 59.5 or 58.5, you know, anywhere in that region, and you'll have it on both sides of the line frequency. That's a pole pass frequency sideband.
Depending on the number of poles, it kind of determines the width.
And the load and the speed, it's all related.
It's all related to it.
So, you know, that's part of the math and the great help of the software, right? But if you do the demodulation where you're filtering out line frequency, well, now the pole pass is no longer a sideband. It's a standalone frequency down around 1 to 2 hertz.
Right? And we actually can put it on envelope around that.
It should be required. And in fact, one of the things we do is we automatically go searching for it, but we do require the end user to actually put a band alarm around that.
Band alarm.
Because what's normal? Okay, unfortunately, if you're just starting in a program, normal may be halfway to the end. But at least you have a baseline and you establish what the first test was, and then if that starts to change, then you pay attention to it.
So next, mechanical speed. How is that determined? how is it shown in our demodulations?
So interestingly, mechanical speed is probably the primary tool used by the vibration industry, right? Almost all of their analysis rotates around, you know, the mechanical speed. So in electrical, even though, you know, it does pass through, so the rotating machinery, whatever it's at, that frequency of rotation does get passed through as a torsional modulation onto the current signal. Guess what? The better balanced your machine is, the less gets passed through this air gap. We talk about air gap, right? Well, for us to see speed of, let's say, a pump, it has to be passed through the shaft, through the rotor, through the air gap, into the stator windings, modulate our current signal, and then we extract it out on a spectrum. Precision balance often makes it very hard for us to actually see the speed frequency, and we have to switch to more of like a dB scale to see the speed peak. So it's...
Well, we can also see it. We see it at the mechanical and the speed peak side.
Right. We always look at the pull pass and speed, compare them. If we don't feel like they're jiving or they're you know, in close proximity, we're going to throw up a flag and say, hey, you might need to maybe use a strobe tack, do something, call your vibration guys. But again, speed can change, so you have to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, we say we can find some mechanical. First of all, we're going to talk about our fan issues. What types of issues with fans can we find?
You know, fans often, just by the sheer fact that they're moving air, you know, there a lot of times you'll have blade issues. You know, if there's been an impingement, if it's been hit by something, a lot of times the mass of a blade will change. If the bearing on the fan starts to go,
it hits something and it. Fan blade is half of it's taken out.
Right.
Could disrupt the current flow because it's different.
Absolutely.
Air. Or
there'll be some turbulence. Absolutely. And that's, a lot of times we'll see that turbulence of air creates an odd torque, and a lot of times it's noisy. In fact, lots of how I see it a lot of times. But any type of balance issue that's related to the fan, if there's any type of a blade issue, if the bearings start to go on the fan, you're going to start to see variations in what, we call blade pass frequency.
And how do you know what blade pass frequency is? How do you know where to look?
Aha. Well, that's the magic, right? So if you're in a vibration, group, and you're looking at blades, you're going to look at the speed of the shaft times the number of blades. But in electrical, keep in mind, we're picking that up through the air gap. Mm-hmm. What do we always talk about occurs in the air gap, right, between the rotor and the stator? What is the relationship there? It's the slip. Right, which is almost synonymous with pull pass, right? So what our calculations involve pull pass rather than speed a lot of times. And so when it comes to the fan issues, we're going to look at, first of all, we want to know on the birth certificate. We always talk about, let's get the motor birth certificate, or let's get the pump birth certificate, or the fan birth certificate. How many blades? That's critical. But rather than multiplying times speed, we multiply it times pull pass frequency. And guess what? Bigger than day, it shows right up in the spectrum, and we're going to put a band alarm around that, right? So again, first test is always a baseline. Unless you already know there's a problem, you're going to say, hey, this is the baseline. Let's add 20, 30, 40% on top of that to put our first caution or severe level. So that's what's going on with the fan issue.
So what about, that's fans. What about belts?
Belts are... Belts are a magical beast themselves, right? And a lot of times you'll see people out there and they'll do the ultra basic, we mentioned a strobe tack. You can go out there and stop a belt from turning and just kind of take a look at it and see what kind of anomalies you might see associated with the belt or or the shiv or
pulleys.
Pulleys, right, exactly. So in electrical, belt frequencies are actually quite dominant, and so if you think about belt frequency, there's a lot of things involved in calculating that. Hopefully, you don't have to do that, but if you do, it involves, what's the distance between the two pulleys? So let's say it's a two pulley system. What's the distance? What's the diameter of the pulley, of the shiv itself, the pulley? All that comes into play, right? But it's a fairly difficult calculation to actually go out with a measuring tool and get it. You know how I like to get it? I like to call the vibration group and say, hey, what's the belt frequency? So if you're just starting your electrical team and you're trying to give some assistance to a belt-driven fan or something as an example, get a hold of the vibration group. Get some information from them up front so that you can populate your program with it and go right to it. Similar to the fan, it's basically but very different. And as I say similar in that we're picking it up through current.
Yeah.
Belt frequency is as what we call a direct pass-through frequency. So it's, for whatever reason, it doesn't require the pole pass as part of the calculation. So once you get it and
so
you identify
really belt speed.
Just belt speed. And then the other thing is
divided by the fundamental frequency, or do you just need...
Well, yeah. So if you're looking at a Hertz spectrum or an RPM spectrum, you know, it's nice to jump back and forth depending on who you're talking to. If you're talking to more machine, mechanical-based, you know, people, then you're going to probably go off RPM, right? If you're more of electrical, they tend to talk about Hertz. But the big thing is, if it's a two-pulley system and the problem is on the belt, where is that going to show up? It's not going to show up at belt frequency because it's going to show up when the belt, and a lot of times there's a gouge in the belt, yeah, or, it, you know, and it's going to, every time it goes through a pulley, it's going to have an anomaly. So a two pulley system is going to have a 2x belt frequency. So once you, let's say if the belt frequency is 10 Hertz, you might see a 20 Hertz as a dominant peak. Well, that means it's more of a belt related thing. If it's the belt frequency itself, the 1x, now you're looking at something that might be more related to, you know, the pulley itself, right? And so that's kind of where the relationship we're looking at is really multipliers. Same in the vibration industry. If you see a harmonic, why is that? You know, and so in this situation, it's not a real harmonic. It's actually a multiplier based on the number of pulleys that are involved.
Yeah. So to your point, what you would do is maybe go out, take some data, go to the DMOD screen and see what are you seeing?
Absolutely.
Is there something at, whatever, 4 Hertz, 9 Hertz, 6 Hertz? If there is, now you got to figure out, backtrack.
Right.
What's causing
it? What is it?
What is it?
Even if you go out with a strobe light,
yeah,
stop the belt and strobe it at 6.8 Hertz. Oh, look at that. There's a 6.8 Hertz. Or guess what? There's a, 13.6, you know, which is 2x, right? Well, it's a two pulley system. And so that's, you know, kind of important to know. Again, if it's occurring at the pulley times the belt frequency, it's probably a belt anomaly itself. If it's a 1x, now it could be passing information through the belt, right? A loose belt has a tendency to flop around a lot of times, and that ends up creating a 1x much higher, so.
What about, also, we can look at compressor issues?
So
looking at there,
compressors have stages, right? And so basically what we're looking at is multipliers for that. So if you have a 4-stage compressor, you need to know what the RPM of the compressor is, multiply that times 4, and that's the frequencies we're looking for. So very similar, you know, to most of the mechanical issues, you know, once you've got the frequency. Now it's a little easier usually, because unless you got like a reduction gear or, you know, something that's changing the speed of the compressor, and that's not unusual, I wouldn't say, but a lot of times it's a direct couple compressor. It's 4-stage, so if it's a 1780, you know, you turn that into a 29 Hertz if you're looking at frequency, and you multiply the speed of the compressor times the stages, that's the frequencies you're looking for.
Okay. What about pump issues?
So pump issues are probably the most closely related to fans, because instead of blades, it's vanes, right?
Okay.
And so there can be some complex pumps out there, but you know, we have numerous case studies tracking vane pass frequencies. You know, in fact, one very recently kind of surprised me, actually. I was thinking that there was far more than what I was seeing. It was like a 4-vane, you know, big circ water pump, and ended up being, you know, a lot of stuff in the way of the water, but it was definitely showing itself up as elevated vane pass frequencies, you know, and we were able to identify that, you know, they were able to go in and clean out the piping. There was a bunch of debris, there was some leftover scaffolding somehow got into the inlet. And you remember there was another case study where we actually, when they inserted the pump into the river, I think they broke part of the inlet plenum completely off. Well, what that did, it didn't damage the vanes or didn't damage the pump impeller or anything, but what it ended up doing was creating a lot of non-linear flow or non-laminar flow. So it was a lot of cavitation that occurred. So a lot of times when it comes to, you know, to pumps, cavitation is one of the big ones. And okay, a lot of times you'll see broadband energy. So we all like to see these spectrums where you got a pretty this and a pretty that and one or two peaks that stand out. When you have cavitation, that's not what you get. You get all kinds of frequencies, right? And we learned a lot about cavitation. You wouldn't have learned this on a carrier, because everybody knows where a carrier is at. But in a submarine, no one should should know where you're at, right? So cavitation was not a good thing. And so we did a lot of study on keeping cavitation from occurring around the screw to make sure that, you know, the enemy submarines couldn't hear us.
Everybody knew where we were at because I was part of the pre-commissioning unit.
Well, that's a good point, yeah. So you weren't even at sea.
We weren't at sea.
Oh, my gosh.
You didn't want to hear my sea. Oh, my sea time was so
brutal.
When you have to do 14 days in a row, that's difficult.
Oh, my gosh. I think we had the same oxygen for 50-some days.
My brother, he was a cook, and he had like 2 beer days out on BB-62, the battleship New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
So he would tell me about his horror stories, and I was like, no.
Battleship's pretty cool.
After day 14, they gave us steak and lobster because we were going in the next day.
What?
Yes, of course.
Oh,
I told you, went the wrong direction. You went under. You stayed above.
Yes, indeed.
So lastly here, we have gear issues, but I might just take us into the next kind of case study that...
Yeah, let's use a case study to actually describe that. That's a good idea.
About the gear issues that we have here. This is a it's a cooling tower fan. So you don't gain access to see the gears and to see the drive gears and the motor itself. It's underneath a shroud. It's 60 hertz, so that's important to know. It's 4-pole. It's 200 horsepower, so it's not a small motor.
That's a decent-sized motor. And what Todd's describing, for those who are listening, is, you know, you drive past a utility plant, you see these, a lot of times you see these massive steam plumes coming off, and everybody thinks, oh my gosh, that's like the nuclear stuff. It's just steam. It's just water being evaporating, and it's a cooling process. So a lot of times these big cooling towers, you know, are exactly that. You know, they've got these giant rotating fans and stuff that are rotating in a shroud, but the motor lot of times is outside where we can access it. And 200 horsepower is a decent sized motor.
So this is a motor drives a double reduction gearbox through a 25-foot drive shaft. Okay. The outboard shaft of the gearbox is connected to a fan used in cooling tower operation, which we talked about. And the gearbox, drive shaft, and fan are all internal within the shroud. So you can't see any of this.
Hats off to the mechanical team that has to align and balance a 25-foot shaft.
Well, even during routine vibration, somebody heard a knocking noise. Okay, so.
The ears are a good technology.
Well, that's, you always say this. It's like, use your senses.
Mm-hmm.
Sight, sound, smell, touch. You know, those are all important. Hearing. I said sound, but those are all very important.
Onboard technologies.
Yeah, onboard, given to you at birth. Let's look at the demodulation data, all right? So the output gear speed is at 112 RPM, and the frequency we need to monitor is at 1.86 hertz. Now, how did we come up with that 1.86 hertz for that 112 RPM shaft speed?
Almost inevitably, this came from a gear reduction number right off the gearbox. It was, you know, whether it's 35:1 or whatever it was, right? And so all they do is take the primary shaft, do the multiplier, and that's the output shaft. So once you figure that out, you know, you build band alarms around the appropriate thing and just sit back and watch and wait for something to happen.
Okay. And we can also look, when we're doing all this type of stuff, we want to look and verify that it's not a rotor issue. So the best way to do that is look at current motor current signature analysis capture and look for pole pass sidebands or fifth harmonic activity, or look at the inrush startup or do a rotor influence check. All of those checked out as we don't see any negative signs on the rotor.
Good approach. Use all, you know, look at all the fault zones and whenever possible, use all the technology you have available to at least baseline a healthy motor.
So the capture of the data was almost for a couple of years, 2016 to 2018, and then during their last test in 2018, most likely when the noise was starting to show up, you start to get multiples of the gear output speed.
And that's critical, because just like we mentioned in the vibration industry, there are certain things that are always indications of advancing problems, and one is harmonics. So if you have frequencies, even if it's of unknown origin, and then all of a sudden you have a bunch of harmonics of that unknown frequency, there's a problem, and it's worth looking into. And the same thing occurs in current. And this was quite a dramatic increase.
Yeah, it can be confusing, because that 1.86 is real close to what pole pass,
absolutely.
So you have to make sure that it's not a pole pass related to the rotor versus a gearbox issue. So those right. are the things that you have to worry about, that when these frequencies are real close to each other, you have to really identify which one is pole pass and which one may be related to the gearbox.
Yep, absolutely. In fact, you know, and I always reference the vibration industry because it's, you know, it's all under the same, you know, maintenance reliability effort. But a lot of times a vibration team will do a you know, a very small FMAX high resolution test just to separate like speed frequency from line frequency on a two-pole motor as an example. And sometimes it's worth looking at that here, you know, zooming in a little bit, making sure that you're differentiating the two frequencies. Do what you can do to make yourself confident that the frequencies you're looking at are actually machine trained, not electrically driven.
Yeah, and it got so bad that it even started to show up in current signature analysis with harmonics of that 1.86. So
yeah, this harmonic content is as high as I've seen on spectrums. When that happens, the problem is advanced. You don't want to put a lot more time analysis and monitoring and trending when you get this type of harmonic content. And for those listening, you know, it went from one peak to like 10 peaks. You know, you have like 9 harmonic peaks outside of the...
When it started, it was at 1.86. Mm-hmm. And then as it got progressively worse, now you have a harmonic out at 2.
2 times 1.86, and 3 times...
3 times,
yes.
4 times, 5 yes. times, 6 times, 7 times that. So that energy is very strong.
Absolutely, yeah. It's indicative of an advanced problem, and based on this being secondary shaft, you know, what we recognize is that it's probably related to the secondary side of the gears. You know, when you're looking at a gear or a gear situation, if the primary shaft is you know, a 4-pole, you know, 1780, but the secondary shaft is like say 500 or 600 or whatever, it's not hard to figure out the number of gears and all that comes into play. The big question is always.
So we knew the speed was 112,
right?
Divided 60 into that came up with that 1.86, and now
it's perfect.
We've found easily.
Yeah, and so what's interesting is a lot of times you try to associate which speed is showing up with the harmonics versus what side of the gear is having the trouble, right? So, you know, in this situation, you know, the initial focus was probably that the secondary side of the gear, because this is a harmonic of the secondary shaft, it's likely the secondary, you know, the higher number of gears, which slows everything down. Just kind of, you know, it doesn't, you know, and it, as we flip through and we look at an actual picture, it's bad.
When they find it and they decide to shut it down and well, the beauty about having knowledge of the problem is you determine when you shut down.
Not in the middle of the summer when the power requirement is so high that it's going to cost you millions of dollars to shut down. Yes.
Yeah, versus during a lower peak time. Mm. You can go in and sure enough, you can see from the gear itself, it was chewed up almost inside. A lot of teeth were missing. Is that what we were seeing as it would go through its revolutions and that those?
Oh, absolutely. So basically what it does is it excites the secondary shaft, right? So, you know, someone's hearing that, if they're hearing a knocking, it's probably just the, you know, as the worst part of the teeth come around and hit the other gear, it's going to create potentially of a variable knocking noise. More importantly, though, the excitation of the secondary shaft indicated that, hey, we've either got a problem somewhere on the secondary shaft. It's either going out towards the fan or into the gear. And a gear is always an easy thing to look at. Now, they should be doing oil tests and oil analysis as well and sending those samples down. But this looks catastrophic in that, you know, you're not, you know, there's major chips being you know, broken. This will probably go back to the manufacturing. They'll do a metallurgical review, make sure that there wasn't some kind of, you know, initial flaw that it was inducive to this problem.
Right. So we talked about it a little bit, but their claim was that because they found it early enough, planned maintenance is key. That's what we're here for. That's what we do.
You know, that's so true. And as a good friend of ours, retired from the utility industry, we called him Big Dog. He'd always say, it's all about the what?
The kilowatts or the
megawatts. It's all about the megawatts.
And so you want to make sure that you get that during a timely, and then they were able to get in and replace that gearbox because it requires a crane, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. a crane. these can be very complicated events and expensive.
You know, the difficult part for the maintenance and reliability guy who's doing this, he's sharing the analysis, he's getting other opinions, he's trying to make sure we're making a good decision. It was an easy decision to say, hey, you've advanced to a severe condition. Now he's trying to weigh how many more weeks or months to the next shutdown so that we're not reducing our power output and costing our you know, stockholders millions of dollars. That's the difficulty of our job is, you know, you don't always have to shoulder that on your own. You know, get another opinion, contact the vendor of the test equipment you're using, you know, see if they have, a lot of times they'll have case studies like the one you're going through. I can guarantee that if the technician knew that that's what the gear looked like, he would have put a high priority on that very next opportunity, we better do something. Because that one's closing in on the end of life, for sure.
Yeah. So they were able to replace that and move on and get new data, and everything is happy. The next case study I want to talk about, and it also involves a gearbox, is there's more to it than just the data. This is a case study that shows the growth and evolution of an individual in his testing practices. When the little we used to call them baby nukes, and they would get their first set of training, and you let them loose on the plane.
Call them nubs.
Nubs, whatever. But even the people who come to our training class with our tester, we tell them you got to kind of crawl before you can walk, and then you can start to really run with the big dogs. And this is absolutely a case study that drives home that point that as you go to conferences, as you go to reliability meetings, as you go and talk to your peers, how you develop your testing strategy can grow. It doesn't have to be defined from day one. You can always keep an open mind and add testing to it. So this is kind of almost the same 7-4 pole, 200 horsepower. This one, the only difference is we know how many slots and we know how many bars.
Which is great. We call it the birth certificate, right? If you can get that information. In fact, you know, it should be part of your motor repair requirement to your shop is, hey, when you send it back, I want to have a report of the number of slots, number of stator slots, number of rotor bars. It just makes the analysis easier.
And this gentleman, like I said, this is part of the growth process where he would go to the CBM meetings or he would go to meetings with his peers and they would say, well, I always do this and I always do that and I always talk to them over the repair facility and I ask them, give me the rotor bar count and give me the slot count. And then that just helps you later on. So in 2015, they did a demodulation test and they identified all these peaks there. And so what they listened to you, right? Establish a relationship with your vibration group. We're all a team. The reliability group is a team. You have the electrical side, you have the mechanical side, you have maybe oil analysis and you have thermography, but you're all working for the same team. You're individual, but yet you are together. So he got, like you had mentioned many times, talked to the mechanical department and they helped him identify this spectrum here. Okay, where we have a peak at 8 hertz, and we have a peak at 12 hertz, and we have a peak at 16 hertz. What does that mean?
Right? They certainly seem related, but we have to figure out. Let's figure out what the source is.
Yeah, and so over time, he never used to do an in-rush startup, which if he ever talked to you, I'm surprised he didn't get that.
He would have known better.
He would have known. Had you trained them.
My favorite test.
It was your favorite test, an in-rush startup test. And guess what? The motor was already started, but does it matter? No. Why can you do an in-rush startup test when the motor's not started or when the motor's already running? Is there benefit to that?
Absolutely. That we nickname that a process analysis because it's up and running, but there's still a lot of good things that can come out of like an RMS envelope of current. So it's wise to do a normal running, in-rush startup test just to see, you know, what kind of torsional effect is going on at steady state. A lot of times it's not steady state.
Yeah. So we come to 2016 and he does, because he just got back from a seminar. And the rest of the guys at other facilities said, oh, I always do an in-rush startup before I start taking the tests. And so he started to do the same thing. And lo and behold, he sees a big 30 amp swing on his normal running current. So that's pretty severe.
It is. It's quite a lot.
Motor, that means something's happening.
Yeah. It's either another question you have to ask yourself. If it's always been there, it may be load induced. If it hasn't always been there, then it's an anomaly induced. It's something's wrong, right? Yeah. Something is changing.
So there are certain things, we don't always look at this parameter, but I wanted to ask you about this load variance. What's so unique about it? What is it telling us?
So every time I open up a demodulation test, I always look over to the right side and I look at that load variance. And basically what it is a direct indicator of how much torque is changing over a period of time, right? So and rather than you trying to do some calculations, whatever, it does it for you, you know, and it says, hey, there's a 2.7% load variance. Okay, so you can say, okay, is that normal? If the load variance is supposed to be 2 to 3%, I feel pretty good about that. But if it used to be, you know, 0.5, and now it's 3. Now
in this case, it was 2, and it went to 9.
That's a big difference.
It's a big jump.
Yeah, I'm looking now at your history chart here. Yeah. Yeah, it used to be 2, and now it's 9. That's a massive increase.
That's a 4 times increase.
Wow.
So that's pretty significant. So that tells you something is happening. And now they, one of the nice things, and either they got this through a tip of the week that you put out. But you say, if you see those peaks that we mentioned at 8 and 12, and I forget what the other one was, 16.
16, right? I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah. Put a band alarm around them. And if it doubles or triples, you want to know that because something's changed.
Absolutely.
And so they did that. And internal and intermediate shaft speed at 6.92 established band alarms around it, and they did. And so it increased by, like we said, 4 times.
It's huge.
And here to come to find out that the gearbox was removed from service and then sent to the shop where they disassembled it, and they found that there was a slight misalignment. Now, the thing about this, and being from the Navy, you and I both, before you would assume a watch, you had to do what?
Usually turnover.
Yeah, you turn over. You turn over the condition of the plant.
Mm-hmm.
You turn over the condition of who's doing maintenance, where, what's tagged out, what's in service, what's not in service. If this was a gearbox that got replaced over a weekend and nobody knew about it, because had he known there was a gearbox change, he would have immediately gone to it and wouldn't have gone to this level of concern.
Mm-hmm.
And had he been looking at in-rush startup, he may have said, hey, what happened over the weekend?
Right, right.
What happened from here to here? But it didn't happen in this case. It took time. Now, having this as a learning curve for him, he's able to, every motor, take a look at.
And once you establish a baseline, here's the thing. My guess is this facility has multiple gears of this nature, you know. And so you start applying the, you know, the Sesame Street song of which one of these is not like the other. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you've got that type of reference, you can establish that, hey, anything more than 2.79%, you know, max load variation deserves some attention. And now you're catching things way early. You know it's coming. You know what's going on. This is a big comfort level for people in the maintenance reliability industry.
So when you think about things to think about or lessons learned, you know, we hear all that terminology. You and I both had it in the military, and kudos and attaboys and aw craps and what does it say? One aw crap takes away 10 attaboys. Or
yes, like yes. That. Yeah, that's so true.
But things to think about, learn the process that's being tested, right? It's so important that you know what you're testing, what's the speed of the shaft, what is it, a pulley system, what is it, a belt, is it a, how many blades in the fan, how many vanes in the pump, how many stages in the compressor. It's so important to know that because it can really certainly help you out later on.
You know, we say a lot of times our technology, and any technology, it really makes the analyst smarter and more knowledgeable of their environment. You know, it's not that it's not, you know, the technology by itself obviously is designed to alert you to problems. But what it ends up doing is forcing us to know our applications better, which makes us a better technician, makes us a better analyst. And that's, you know, anything that can make you, you know, smarter about your environment, about your application knowledge is obviously a good thing.
Yeah, work as a team with your group members there. I mean, you're in the reliability field. You're there to make the plant more reliable. And we always say, what does vibration say? What does thermography say? You know, you're going to be much more comfortable making a decision if you have multiple data points and technologies pointing in a direction.
Right, and the little fun side of it is there is a little good competition, right?
Sure.
It's great to be the first one to point out an anomaly, not the one to confirm it. It's a good either way, but that's why I always say, hey, get to know the operations guy and bring him a drink every once in a while or her a drink every once in a while water, of course. And, you know, that way when they start to see something going wrong, they don't know they can't quantify it, but they can qualify it, right? So give me a call first, you know, so I can come in and use electrical tools to, you know, to identify an anomaly. Then we'll get the mechanics in and let them do it.
That's a little bit devious, but I'm
it's all part of the fun.
That's fun.
Beat them to the punch, you know.
Remember, we're all working as a team. Though.
But as a team.
As a team. We all want to work together to solve these issues. We don't want to create animosity.
Just good competition. Just good, healthy competition.
Yeah. So get to know those people and attend conferences, for goodness sakes. That's very beneficial. Make them useful. Mm-hmm. When you have people there, we get so much information when we're, even as an exhibitor, we talk to customers and we sitting in classrooms and stuff and listening to what they say. It gives us ideas on, well, how do we solve that issue? How can we have our technology possibly solve that issue? And it's very important. And get with reliability members and find out all of those things we talked about with veins and teeth and all that, and can only help you. So that kind of brings us to the end of the seventh, maybe.
Fault zone machine train analysis.
Machine train analysis.
Or it's not the motor.
Or it's not the motor. It's potentially something else, which is could be a good thing.
Could be.
Noah, thank you for your information.
Always my pleasure.
We're happy that you shared all that with us, and thank you guys for paying attention and listening, and hopefully you got just a little bit out of today to make your life a little more efficient tomorrow. I think that's the word of
phrase that pays.
Phrase that pays, actually, yeah. If you can become a little bit more efficient, a little bit more knowledgeable, take a little bit of what you learned and say, I'm going to try this and become a little bit better at your job, I think things will work out in the end for everybody, including yourself. So anyways, until the next podcast where we're talking to you, everybody have a safe day, and we look forward to talking to you real soon.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Todd and Noah Show. We'll be back for another episode very soon. In between, we hope to see you in the Mobius Connect online community, where you can network, learn, and share with Todd and Noah and other industry professionals at mobiusconnect.com, and we will see you there soon.